So I think we're going to go ahead and get started. It's now 2:02. Thanks for coming. I'm Thor Muller, and this is Judo Moves for Defending Your Online Reputation. Let's see, we all come together every year at South by Southwest to celebrate all that is good and right in the world of the internet, which is fundamentally this open, pretty transparent place. And we are in large part here by virtue of that openness and that transparency. But there is a dark underbelly that some of us are aware of, some of us have experienced. And if we haven't yet experienced it, it's likely that sometime in the course of our lives we will. What am I talking about? Well, there's at least two sides to it, but the ones that we're going to talk about today are, the fact that the internet is just a wide net that can pick up every little thing that is said about you, your business, and that just accrues over time thanks to the disturbing power of Google, the flattening power of its search results. The other thing is the fact that in a matter of an hour, something can happen, an event can happen, maybe an interview gone wrong, and everything can change. What do you do then? So these are the kinds of things which make the internet a dangerous place. But my thesis, and the thesis I think a lot of really smart people, is that we can harness that openness. We can harness the very things which threaten our survival, the survival of our reputation. We can harness those things for good. We can use a judo move to change the dynamic. So I'm going to start off with some words from David Brin, a famous science fiction writer, wrote The Postman.
You're going to have on the corner of your eyeglasses a little camera, or your eyeglasses, or your sunglasses, in Werner Vinge's great new novel, Rainbow's End, even in a contact lens that you have. You're going to be walking down the street, and it's going to scan people's faces as they go by, look them up on registries, and provide captions on the inner surface of the contact lens of the eyeglass, basically identifying everybody who's walking past you. Not only their names, but depending upon how you dialed your glasses and your preferences, you may get the first sentence of their public profile that they want out there, or you might have tuned your glasses to give dissenting opinions from their ex-spouses, or to put mustaches on everybody walking by. This is called augmented reality, and we are going to head towards this godlike power added to our other godlike powers. If you don't think you already have godlike powers, when was the last time you saw an event happening live far around the world, or when was the last time you flew through the sky? Every time we have gotten these godlike powers, people have wrung their hands and moaned about how it was the end of everything, and then they got used to it.
I can't tell how clear that was, because from here it's kind of hard to tell what, just iffy. So let me say that I have a lot of video interviews and some audio in here, and if we can't hear it, then I'll just tell you what people are saying, and we'll skip past that. The reason why I wanted to use interviews was because as I started doing research on this subject. And I've been talking to people for years. We started a business called Get Satisfaction, largely around what we learned. But specifically over the last couple of months, I've been talking to people. I really thought that their stories were the ones that you should hear. I can summarize them, but it's most moving when they talk about them. When I initially outlined this presentation, it was very much a polemic. It was very much about, I was going to throw a disclaimer in there and say, this is about, you shouldn't even try to control your reputation. You should embrace openness and make no apologies for that. In the research, I discovered that that is easy for me to say, but a lot harder for many people who have higher stakes than I do and maybe some a bit greater downsides. So there's a more nuanced story that emerges here. But what David Brin was talking about is a future which is basically here. He's talking about the near future where everybody, where there's cameras everywhere, essentially not just in your phones, but they might be the size of stickers on signposts, and they're beaming videos up to the web without anybody even knowing of it. And he looks at that as potentially scary if governments and large corporations control that data. But if we all have access to that information, then we're watching the watchers, and we can actually retain more privacy as a result of embracing more transparency. But we already have many of these tools. We may not have cameras everywhere with subtitles in our contact lenses telling us who people are and what their ex-spouses say about them. But what we do have is Google. We have, if you're a venture capitalist, you have the funded. If you're a small business in San Francisco, you have Yelp and so forth and so on. Our business Get Satisfaction does this for our companies and their customer service. So increasingly, we do have access to that unbridled stream of information. David Brin calls it a superpower. So the question is, how will we get used to our new superpowers? Will we use them for good, or will we use them for evil? There are many yous and me's on the internet. And this is part of one of the great shifts that we're going through right now, is that we're used to small communities and cultivating reputation in small communities. eBay. You think a lot of people have developed the new systems, even some startups around the reputation systems in eBay. What is eBay? It's basically a binary system, even though there's a multiple star rating. You either have a good reputation or a bad reputation. And that's easy to do in a community where the rules are bounded. eBay reputation is meaningful, even a binary reputation, because either you send money when you're supposed to, or send the Pez dispenser, the limited edition that you're supposed to when somebody's bought it, or you don't. And that accrues in the form of the simple reputation. But we live in the world of networks. And so one of the questions, looks like I got my slides out of order. One of the questions I have for you, for all of us, is what does reputation look like in the world of the network? I'd argue that it's a lot more complex, and it requires the viewer to do a lot of interpretation for themselves. But we already do this. We've been doing this for years. If you're a Democrat and you talk to a Republican and they're bashing your candidate, you discount their opinion about that candidate, right? So this is not a new thing, but on the internet, of course, we are seeing this explode. So if you are an open source advocate and let's say you're doing a job interview and you meet somebody who's an open source advocate, you Google them, you find out that they've been personally bashed, then you can see that they've been bashed by a Microsoft supporter. Okay, so maybe you can discount that. So that's what's changing about reputation. But meanwhile, there are many people who would like you to think about this in a traditional way. How can you control your reputation? So Reputation Defender takes a very traditional approach to this. Now, they may offer a great service, but they are selling a lie, and that lie is that you can control your reputation. You may be able to curate it, but this idea, if you look at some of the language they use, they search and destroy what people say about you. And this reflects a concept of a relationship with other people, right? A relationship where you search and destroy their free speech. That's a little frightening. So, I'm having troubles with my clicker. I broke this presentation into five acts. They're really five. Well, the first act is the six judo rules. This is the distillation of what I've learned over the course of this research and running Get Satisfaction. And then the other four acts are stories. They're stories that bring to life how people are using these rules. Now, what I'd like to do, because I have no idea whether I'll finish on time, is at the end of each act, open it for any questions that you may have. So I think there's a mic back there. Hopefully it's turned on. So we don't run into a situation where there's no time at the end, because I'm sure there are people out here who know far more about some of these things than I do. So act one, six judo moves. Before I get into the moves, let me just point out that there's a bit of a conflict here when you're dealing with the subject, and that is that reputation management often runs headlong into the interest of privacy and free speech. And so we'll see some of these issues over and over again. People trying to balance out their need to defend their reputation with their own privacy, the privacy of others, and free speech. So where do I come from with all this? Me, along with my founding team, some of whom are sitting over here, started a company called Get Satisfaction. And the basic concept here is that if you're a company, you're extremely vulnerable to what other people can say about you. And people may blog about you, they may write about you in forums or Yelp, etc. The problem that we have, that companies have, is how do they respond? And many times when companies respond on somebody else's blog, they get there's a blowback. They're considered defensive, rude, out of place, etc. So Get Satisfaction is a place where people can talk about companies, whether it's a complaint, a question, an idea, whether or not the company's involved, but the company's invited to come and participate and work with their customers in this Switzerland for companies and customers. So that's where I come from. Rule number one, judo move number one, cast a long shadow. Now, this is just a basic rule, and I think we're all pretty familiar with this. If there are no Google search results for your name, and somebody writes something about you that is unfavorable, then that comment goes straight to top, right? That will then dominate your reputation online. So it stands to reason that accruing more content about you, ideally favorable, ideally expressing who you are, will help to inoculate you against the odd comment that you don't like. So this isn't necessarily a grand strategy, but it's a baseline, right? This is where bloggers have a great advantage because they're constantly producing content that expresses what they're thinking and what they believe. So there's a context for any comment outside of that. And context goes a long way, as I described before. I also love this quote, David Brin again. In a world where anyone can bear false witness, try to make damn sure there are lots of witnesses. So I've been going around and talking to people here at the conference as well. And so this is Julie. Hold on a sec. Okay, so here we go. This was a post that was written by Valleywag. Julie's over here in the office, in the audience. This is a post that Valleywag wrote that was pretty scurrilous. They basically spread a rumor that Jimmy Wales, founder of Wikipedia, has a bimbo problem, and then just targeted two women who he happened to be hanging out with, friends of his, but then called them Jimbo's bimbos. Now, Jilly over here felt like this was your response.
So I was divided about what to do about it because I didn't want to reinforce what they were doing by linking back to them and giving them the authority to do that. But I decided that ultimately I should say something. I should say that I know what they're doing. I know what they're doing is crap and that it doesn't really mean anything and that I recognize it and I see it and I'm just moving beyond it. So I posted to my blog a brief blog post basically making fun of what they were doing and just sort of like moved beyond it. And I also started sending that my response blog post to people who I've been associated with professionally. And so they can see that and so they can see that I am recognizing that this is lame and that I'm moving beyond it and that it's untrue.
Right.
So preemptively, before they see this and start thinking, well, what was going on?
So she told her side of the story. And this is a theme you see over and over again with people who have seem to master the power of their own reputation. They know how to tell their own story in a way which is engaging and non-defensive. And they'll use terms like proactive. Another example here of that.
This is wrong. It has changed my behavior in one significant way, and that is, like, I had one particularly weird meeting where I had an entrepreneur that I was on a call talking to him, and it was not going well, and he ended up hanging up on me, you know, saying not so nice things and hanging up on me. And my first thought was, yeah, I bet he's going to go to the funded now. So I immediately actually posted in my blog about that meeting, preempting any activity in the funded, which, as it turns out, never happened.
Interesting. So you're now taking a defensive approach to...
No, it's a proactive
approach.
Interesting. So again, this is the site, The Funded, where entrepreneurs can go and talk about VCs and basically peel open... the idea is, whether or not it works is controversial, but peel open the flow of information about VCs that VCs have always had about entrepreneurs and their back channel. And so it's starting to change behavior. And the other thing, again, is that it's the thinking about this is proactive rather than defensive changes the tone you use when you talk about it, and that's important. The next judo move is apologies. Now, great companies like Southwest Airlines, great example, they have a chief apology officer who has mastered the art of saying, I'm sorry. And they'll send vouchers and so forth, but his crowning achievement is actually finding new and personal ways of saying, I'm sorry. If he just sends a form letter, it's not heartfelt. And another example, this was JetBlue a year ago when their CEO apologized on YouTube for a terrible incident where airlines were sitting on runways for 12 hours at a time, people trapped inside, toilets overflowing. But what was interesting about his apology was he did it in a third-party space on YouTube and left comments open. We'll see this in the coming judo moves, but that opened him up to harsh criticism, but it was in the context of that apology, so it transformed that criticism. Now, I'm going to do... my next example is very current.
Sarah, what happened?
I made the mistake of...
Sarah, what happened?
This is her apology.
I don't know. I made the mistake of coming to a developer conference, unfortunately. No, I think, honestly, like, I talked to the Hugh McLeod from Sell Myself Support, and he said, don't do a Q&A, and then there were people lining up the microphones. Like, they've been...
So, the mistake she makes, of course, is that she... apologizes by blaming the audience. Now, what you see over here, this is today's Google result. Now, Google, on the one hand, rewards links that have been around for a long time, but they've rejiggered their results recently to also show things which are in the zeitgeist. Down here, the second of the two outlined results is... very critical reporting of the incident yesterday. But interestingly, the apology video is above it. This was a great opportunity for her to transform the conversation. And I know how hard it is to be in the middle of something and to just be flustered, so I don't want to pick on Sarah, but it's a great example that is very current of how the right kind of telling your story and maybe an apology, if an apology was necessary, could have really transformed the conversation around it. So the next judo move is inspiring an army. It's sometimes not enough to tell your own side of the story and apologize yourself. If you can get other people to tell it for you, then it's 1,000% more effective. And if I can figure out where my cursor is, I'll get this video going.
Well, if you're a young person in the venture capital world and you haven't started Google or Facebook or a really successful company, you don't have much to rely on except the way that you treat people, your reputation for interacting with entrepreneurs, right? Because if you have some huge home run behind you, you can always point to that and say, you know, I can treat you however I want because I know what I'm talking about because I'm the founder of some famous company. But I'm not in that position. So as a result, I need to treat entrepreneurs with respect and try to help them when I can. And the funded became a way for entrepreneurs who felt like I was helping them to express that, so that I could point to that and say, you know, this is who I am, this is my credibility. And I saw that happening on the funded. I saw the trend that was happening, and I recognized that either you could ignore it and, you know, let whatever people want to say, or you could try to take the opportunity and encourage people to go there and, you know, jot a little note about what it's like working with me, so that other people might be inclined to want to work with me and do business with me.
But people can say,
next judo move, stand for something. Now we have Patty Roll in the office, in the audience here. Can I get you to come up for a minute? I wasn't able to get her on video, so we'll do a little live Oprah thing here. But the idea here is that it's, again, context. If somebody knows that you're an evangelist for something, that you stand for something that's greater than just making money or your self-interest, then you can withstand a blizzard of criticism and in the process create an army that will tell your story for you. So, Patty, well, can you tell us how you've used your mission as a company to engage with your customers?
Well, one of the things we did was we started using Get Satisfaction. As you can see on our homepage, we're giving them a lot of advertising, which is great. I think that we started using our voice again. There was about a 7-year hiatus that I had left the company, and it had gone through 3 different owners. And when I came back, I realized that we used to have a point of view, a really strong point of view. We were snarky. And we had lost that in those 7 years. And so we started being snarky again. And that was tough for some people who hadn't known Timbuktu to have a point of view. So we sent out, I do the emails, and I sent some sort of what I thought were really funny emails. One on our limited edition bags that said, here today, gone tomorrow, just like that jerk who stole your virginity. Which I understand that could be taken wrong. And on the web, there are watchdogs for these kinds of things. And so there was a lot of heat that we actually was interesting, because we have a list of, you know, people that opt in for us. And so we have 10,000 or something that go out and they register and they're evangelists, and they had no problem. It was the sort of the concentric, you know, reverberation. It was the third ring out that the women's sort of rape advocacy or I'm the rape advocate. They're the ones that are watching me. But it just exploded where I do a news I use Net News Aggregator, and it was amazing within 2 weeks just how many women were like, you guys suck. Like, it is not funny that you're making fun of someone getting raped. And I was like, I'm not making fun of someone getting raped. I thought it was really funny. And so there was a lot of correspondence with me directly back to their blogs just saying, look, like, I think it's funny. Of course I don't want other people to get raped. Of course that's not what we're saying. But then what happened on Get Satisfaction, or before Get Satisfaction, but on the blogs, is that other people from Timbuktu who were evangelists started responding in as well. And they were like, my God, you guys lighten up. Like, it's great to hear something or get something in your email box that's really funny. And so we've seen that same kind of defense from outside of our own employee base happen on Get Satisfaction. And we've been much more, I'll say that I've been much more conscious, still I think amusing and still funny and still with a point of view, but a lot more careful about what I, because my sense of humor isn't everyone's sense of humor. And unless you're in the presence of someone, and if you think of Timbuktu as a big company, which I can't believe people do, but they do, that you have to be more sensitive and realize that whatever message you're giving out isn't always easy to interpret if you're not in the presence of that person. So on Get Satisfaction, we've been able to use a much more casual voice with the customers, which is great because it's not it's somewhat unofficial because it's not an email response to a customer service at Timbuktu.com, but we're finding a lot more conversation going back and forth with the consumers because of that. And we do make a lot of mistakes. When you decide that you're going to be more vocal and give people in the company the ability to talk to your consumers, you make mistakes. That's part of the gig. But what I find is true in any relationship that you're honest and you try to not speak from a defensive point of view, and that sometimes takes a day for me to not take things really personally that happen or things that people say about us and our bags and whether we're legit or not legit, or it's hard not to be really take that personal. And so usually I'll just wait for 24 hours or something until I feel a little bit calmer and have a little bit better perspective, and that tends to work with my fiance as well.
So that's all great. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Timbuktu's mission, because you start every day with this goodwill, right? That comes from your labor practices, yeah, and your commitment to sustainability and a certain lifestyle, and that all seems to have bred a community around you that's far and wide. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's been a big impact on how people respond?
You know, I think most of the people that I talk to here, and I've done more speaking engagements, not as many as I'd like to do, but more this last year, and everyone has a story about their bag or when they bought their bag, or I've had my bag for 8 years, and I've had my bag for 8 years, and so I know how I feel about it. But that I think we got really lucky because we're based in San Francisco. We grew up with Adobe because the first bag builder was in Flash, and we were one of the first product companies that got to, that Adobe used as an example. So we got a lot of exposure, way more than we deserved early. And I think, too, that there's something about a small company that legitimately came up on the backs of working messengers that says, we've been there. Like, it was a bitch when we got started, and we were trying to buy more machines in 1998, and we didn't have enough capital, and so we took this loan from this really weird guy, and he was, like, hanging out waiting for his payment and in his car outside the office late at night, and it was like, we went through all of that. And so now we have, I think, a fan base that likes their bag, and luckily we make really good bags, because I don't think you could get there without making quality product, and customization has really helped us because it's more their bag. Like, if you build your bag, it's more yours than anything that you would buy off of a shelf. So I think those things have kept us really active, maybe, in the community of people who use them. And so we've been able to engage, and we're doing, like, the picture that Mark Emery picture that's on the homepage right now, is all the images on the site are community sourced now. And that guy, we're, like, selling his patches on the site because we got so many emails asking about how they could get one. And that guy's really a awesome guy, and he lives in San Francisco, and he comes and hangs out at the office now. So there's just stuff like that where you start to be more available to your customers. And for us, we're really lucky because we're not that controversial. I mean, we make bags. We don't do a lot in the political sphere beyond a 0.09 tenths patch. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Big hand for Patty.
Thanks.
So I originally had 5 judo moves, but I discovered another one which is becoming more and more powerful and more and more present. So that one is celebrate your critics.
I'm Ryan Taylor. I'm making a video right now of people criticizing me. And this was all before I met Thor. Actually, just met Thor about 30 seconds ago. And I'm making this video basically to show people that I'm fairly lighthearted, and also because who's going to believe positive press, especially if it's coming from me? So since I can take a joke, I've got pretty thick skin, I figured, why not try some negative publicity? Because they say there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Do you hope that by celebrating the criticisms that you'll make it harder for real criticisms to actually stick?
I think so, and here's why. Because I'm doing it in a very satirical way. It's all a joke. It's a big joke, so any critics would kind of be pulled into that joke. So they wouldn't know, is he joking about disliking that feature about me? Or is he, or if you don't ask the or, actually. That's the point, so, yeah.
So that's very interesting. And I have another amazing example in Act 5 that will blow your mind. But it's counterintuitive, but why not celebrate the worst of the haters in your life? What would that do, right? So think about that. I'm going to stop now just momentarily and see if there's any questions. That's Act 1. Those are 6 judo moves. And each individually is useful, but all 6 together are transformative. So any questions at this point? Well, I think that Patty was talking about her personal emotions, those of us who have a community around our product, what? The question was, is there a contradiction between waiting 24 hours to cool down, the cooling down period, so you can respond in a level-headed way, and the responding quickly, being proactive? Yeah. Well, what proactive is in terms of time is going to differ depending on the situation and who you are. But I think that Patty's point, which is really important, is that you need to know yourself. So I showed that the video of Sarah, who maybe needs more time to collect her thoughts around what happened, and her response then is going to be a lot more meaningful. So she may have not been fair to corner her like that, but it happened. So that's the reality, is that we have to be aware of our own cooling down periods. There's a timer on these things. You know, think about the political races right now, where the last days before a primary, the negative attack ads hit, and you have to respond. I mean, you're pissed off as the candidate. You know, you don't necessarily have the right answer, but you have to. And I think that those of us who have living, breathing communities, particularly those that can get satisfaction, where these are your customers and they have immediate issues, timeliness is critical. So not necessarily a contradiction, but a challenge. Act 2. Are there any more questions? All right. Act 2, griefer madness. Now, a griefer is like a troll. They live to make life hell for people. And one of the most notorious of these griefers was Michael Crook. He actually changed his name to Michael Crook. He took that on himself, and I'll show you where that ended up in a moment. But he's been doing this for years, but this particular episode starts with an interview he did on Fox.
One man feels that our troops are overpaid. That's only the beginning. ForsakeOurTroops.info calls wounded soldiers leeches, celebrates when a serviceman is killed in action. Joining us now is the creator of ForsakeOurTroops.info, is Michael Crook. Let's just go through this here step by step. You, your goal is to bring attention partly to the military issue. You say it's not a joke, it's not a hoax. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm very serious about what I'm doing.
Okay. You say, don't military pukes learn anything. You put that on your website, correct?
That is correct.
9 more Marines bite the big one in combat. Stupid is as stupid does. You put that up there, sir?
That is correct.
Yeah, by the way, those people that you're calling stupid that bite the dust allow morons like you to say stupid things like that, by the way. You call our troops these scumbags who probably couldn't hack it in the workforce. The U.S. soldier is a poster child for retroactive abortion. That's how you feel, sir?
That is honestly how I feel.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He said it. So this is an interesting one, because here's a guy. This is an anecdote of a guy who has destroyed his own reputation, okay? He's done all the... I'm not here to advise him, but we're going to learn some interesting things, because what happens next is that image of him on Fox News becomes fodder for critical bloggers. Now, other stuff has happened after the Fox interview, which I won't go into, but suffice to say, it gets worse. Okay, if he can make his own reputation worse, he does it. And bloggers like Boing Boing take up the cause. They pull the screenshot and they post it. At this point, I'm going to introduce Jason Schultz, a lawyer from the EFF, who was brought in to litigate the case.
The case that we took at EFF, somebody was blogging about Michael Crook, about all of his nefarious tactics, and in doing so, posted a photo of him from a Fox News interview that he had done a couple years before. Well, Michael Crook sent a copyright takedown notice to take down the blog post, and in doing so violated the law, and so we got involved.
Now, the law that he violated was the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which allows for anybody whose copyright's been violated, like let's say your film is posted on YouTube without your consent, gives you the ability to send a takedown notice to YouTube, which provides serious penalties on the offender, in this case, in that example, YouTube, if they don't comply. And it turns out that the copyright violation is indeed true. But this is a case where Fox News had the copyright, and this Michael Crook fellow decided that he would use that provision to try to control his reputation, okay, basically abusing the law. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation got involved to try to... What happened next was pretty hilarious. People had a field day with Michael Crook. So in trying to control his image, it got even worse. So EFF litigated this, and as a result, Michael Crook was forced to make a video apology. I'll show a little bit of this.
My name is Michael Crook, and as part of the settlement of the case between Jeff Deal and myself, I'm here to state my regret for misusing the Digital Millennial Copyright Act to take down speed shots of myself on the Fox News channel. The appearance took place early 2005, almost 2 years ago. When I filed the DMCA notices, I did not have any fraudulent intent, nor did I do it in an attempt to shut Mr. Deal's 10zenmonkeys.com site down. I had an honest belief that one could control their image when it was used contrary to the original intent.
Well, that's really interesting. He was under the impression that you could control your image if it goes against your intent. Well, he was wrong. And he's lived to suffer the consequences. Act three, I know I said I'd stop for questions, but we're running a little bit short of time, so we'll save them until a little bit later. Act three, a tale of two lawyers. First lawyer is one we've just met. His name is Jason Schultz. And
a lot of people ask the EFF, well, why did you want him to do this video? Why was that part of the settlement? And part of it was because we wanted this to be a lesson that other people could learn from. We wanted the story to have an ending. Oftentimes in court settlements, they're just paper documents and nobody pays attention to what happens. But this was a chance to kind of get the final epilogue so people could see that abusing a law is not a good thing. It hurts free speech. And in fact, the answer to speech you don't like is more speech, which is your video. So Michael Crook actually got to tell his own story. He just had to make the video, and that's kind of how we wanted the case to end, was with his story instead of his lawsuit.
What's interesting about this is that the EFF, in litigating the misuse of the DMCA, actually helped Michael Crook improve his own reputation, because all of a sudden Michael Crook became a human being who was apologizing. Now, it was a scripted apology, and I mean, nobody really could take that part of it seriously, but it completely changed the terms of conversation around Michael Crook. And it showed that openness could be used as not just a tool for reputation, but as a legal tool. As far as I know, and Jason, have there been any other cases where the settlement included a video apology? Yeah. So this was a first. Well, it'll be interesting to see if we see more of it. Because there's nothing as permanent as, arguably permanent as your reputation. And online, it's even in some ways more indelible, which is controversial. Is it okay as a judge or a jury to make somebody wear a scarlet letter? In this case...
Right, he is forever marked with
the scarlet C for copyright abuse.
Yeah, exactly. Now, was there any reservations on your part or the part of EFF for doing that to him?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, a lot of discussion was had about the video and whether that was an appropriate thing. But I think if you put yourself out there on the web, and you do so in a way where you attack other people, you kind of have a responsibility to own up to that. And so in this instance, with him having gone on the attack, we felt it was appropriate that he would have to own up to that in the video. So yeah, I mean, it's something that's going to last for a long time. But on the other hand, if anything bad happens to you online, you can make that kind of fall away if you start doing good things, right? So Google ranks things on popularity and relevance and these kind of tactics. And so there's almost an incentive for you to then go and do really nice things or good things or productive things so that any bad things you've done sort of fall off the ranking. And so we thought that was actually kind of a nice incentive.
So Jason goes on in this interview to talk a bit about how he believes that openness ultimately accrues to his benefit, and that he's now a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, but when he was at the EFF, he earned the scorn of certain large corporations. I forgot to plug the computer in. He earned the scorn of large corporations such as those in the entertainment industry who called him a mob attorney and an ambulance chaser, things like this, which, if you're a lawyer, your reputation is even more important because if you have the perception of... can I get some help over here? Thanks. If you're perceived as having a conflict or being unethical, that can really damage your standing with the bar. So reputation is even more important. So it makes Jason's stance, which was bring it on, all the more interesting, because what his point was is that because he stood for free speech, because the organization he worked for took a giant stand, it was synonymous with free speech, that the critiques that and large entertainment companies could throw at him would hold no water with the average thinking human. So, that's lawyer number one.
Right, he is from Mars.
Right. I'm going to jump ahead here to lawyer number two. Who's a very different situation.
Okay, so I'm a domestic violence and children's advocacy attorney. And that means that I represent women in court, we're seeking restraining orders, or basically anything that relates to domestic violence in civil court. I don't do criminal, but I also represent children in dependency hearings and some family law in general. But mainly it is representing victims of domestic violence.
So this is not her. This is just an avatar. In the next couple of slides with where I interview her, they're just screens of various avatars. She did not want to be interviewed on video because, as you'll see, there's a conflict between openness, at least in part of her life, and being effective in her job. So I think this is an interesting counterexample to sort of belief in the power of openness that many of us have, though she doesn't take it to an extreme.
I would prefer to be an open person, but there's no doubt that some people in the social justice arena are more conservative, not necessarily with regard to politics, but lifestyle choices. So I should probably preface this by saying I have a very active social life. I worked as a fashion designer prior to law school, and I'm sort of known for my costuming and outfits and, wearing sort of outrageous things, which is great. It's been wonderful fun. But I tend to wear the kind of stuff that people want to take pictures of and put on their blogs. So I'm totally fine with that. If I don't want to be photographed, I don't get photographed. But I don't like it when people use my name because I don't want someone to Google me and come up with, a picture of me in a crazy Marie Antoinette outfit with my head hanging off.
So she's made a hard line between being open in her professional life and being open in her personal life. And she goes on to say in the next couple of slides, in the next couple of portions of the interview, which I'm going to skip past right now, that she actually goes around and asks people nicely to either take it down, but more importantly, to ask them to just use a different name, her initials, something like this. So unlike Reputation Defender, she's not trying to search and destroy those who would publish what they want. She's just trying to separate those two worlds a bit. And the benefits, the reason why she has to do it is not just to maintain propriety, but because it actually to open herself up personally to people who, some of whom are beating their wives or harassing their own children, she could become into the firing line. So there's actually a safety issue. So I think it's important when we talk about openness as a way of managing reputation, we take our own context into consideration. Everybody's situation is different. However, in her, when asked about, and we'll play this. Oops, hold on a sec.
That I absolutely cannot have 100% control about what is written about me on the internet. No one can. However, there is a sort of cast a long shadow. So for me, there is so much about my domestic violence and children's advocacy on the web, things that I've said, work that I've done, cases that I've worked on, that even if something were to go up that was controversial or potentially damaging to me, you would tend to look at all that other stuff first.
So she uses openness in her own career to cultivate a reputation that it would be hard to damage with a single situation or critique. So I'm going to skip forward here. I'm going to go through Act 4 quickly. Act 4 is a story of a photographer, Lane Hartwell, who came into the firing line last year when she tried to enforce her own copyright. Now, she used the DMCA in a proper way, where she thought that her copyright, it was a photograph that she had taken, was being used without permission. The people who used it thought it was fair use, and then a giant controversy ensued when they accused her of trying to stamp down creativity when it didn't meet her needs. What's interesting about this story is that we're seeing some themes here, right? The DMCA being used, being misused. In one case, the user of a DMCA is a true villain. In this particular case, he's just a struggling photographer trying to make a living and enforce what she thinks are her rights. But she's villainized in the process. And so let me play with a little bit of this here.
Wasn't really aware of the DMCA or any of the implications, and I understand now that it's used by big corporations to kind of go against the little guy. And it's been very interesting in my case because I've seen similar cases where a person in my situation would have been considered the little guy, would have been considered the David,
sure,
against the Goliath. But in my case, I was considered the person that was the big, I was offending this creative group of individuals who wanted to make art, and how dare I do that? Like I was, some big corporation or something. And I'm a... Well, first there was...
Apologies. What happened in the end, it became a giant blow-up. TechCrunch came down against her, which caused more of a pile-on effect. It was a very difficult 3 weeks or so for her. But what happened as a result of this is that... In her case, she defended herself. She represented her side of the story. A growing community of other artists came and joined her in articulating the rights of artists who were trying to engage in openness, but felt like their work was being stolen. And in the process, she became associated with standing up for herself and for her clients. Today, despite that extremely rocky 3 weeks, she has more clients than she's ever had, and many of whom have said when they've reached out to her that her willingness to stand up for her rights and her, by extension, her clients' rights, made her the most attractive option as a photographer. Okay, Act 5. So this is an interesting one. Aaron Crumley reached out to me when he saw that we were doing this presentation, and he wanted to explain a story that happened to him recently. He's a filmmaker. He made a film called Four-Eyed Monsters, and he also has a film festival. Several months ago, he had some of his stuff stolen, and he made this video, which he posted to his blog.
I was robbed last night at one of the best parties I've been to in a long time.
with one of the best groups of people that I've been around in a long time. I spoke with almost everyone at that party and got a really good vibe from practically everyone. Yet, at the end of the night, when the lights came back on, my coat that had my passport that I need to go to Berlin, my wallet full of maxed out credit cards I'm trying to pay off, and my video recorder full of a bunch of footage I still need to import was not in the coat area.
So he goes on to ask the network of in his community to share this video with everybody to see if the stolen goods will turn up. What happens next is crazy. He posts this, and every pubescent boy shows up to tell him what a jerk he is, and much worse, as you'll see. And what he does is judo move number 6. He celebrates his critics in a really extraordinary fashion. So we have some
that last video that I posted has enraged the internet, which has never happened in the 84-plus videos that I've posted online before. I've noticed the world is becoming an extremely hostile place. So I've put together a mashup of all of my favorite hate comments and emails.
Fuck you! I hate you! And your stupid stuff that got stolen too! Go back to California and get your daddy to buy you a new bicycle, asshole! I stole your video recorder, you cunt! And I'm gonna use it to film my big dick getting put inside of you and post that as a video response on YouTube entitled, Fuck You! Hey man, that's a nice suit, but you're totally fucking tripping. Dude! That microphone looks like a dildo, and so do you!
Shit gets took, nigga!
They sold your bike to buy crack, and you're never gonna get your wallet back. Faggot, face it, you're gonna have to replace it. Meanwhile, I'm gonna be using your passport as a dull knife to slice your balls off.
He transformed it. And here I am. A few months later, showing a bunch of people in a crowded room. So, and that's what I'm talking about. That's a judo move. I'm going to stop there. And if there's a few questions, I think we have, it's 2:54 by my clock. Yeah? Is it 6? Okay. Are there any questions in the audience? Comments? Well, that's a bad sign.
Thor?
Yes.
It's Heather.
Oh, hi, Heather.
Hi. This has been good follow-up to the gossip to-do we had yesterday. Here's my question that I'm left thinking about after that conversation, which is how do you internally, you talk a lot about techniques in these conferences, but it seems like the part that's hardest for people is their emotional hurt. So how do you internally deal with the idea that you can't control what people say about you or think about you and argue what people say about you? I mean, what lets you be in a calm enough place so that you can deal with the fact that we live in a world where people say, I'm going to use my passport as what a dull knife to slice your balls off.
That's a great question. And I think it's important to remember that these are extraordinary people, all the ones I showed. And there are many more who are afraid to leave their house. Or they're afraid to go anywhere near the kind of toxic sludge that can come out of some people, and so they let it sit. In many cases, it just goes away, it just fades away. But when something real happens, what I'm talking about here are the tools, the practical tools that people can use. But yeah, the emotional stuff, I think, is the most mystical, mystifying stuff, because clearly. He's got thick skin, right? But then he's been doing this for a long time. He's done it. He's developed that. So I know that every time we get a critical comment, about our business, and ours is all public because we use our own software to have those conversations. It's painful to do it. But what I found is that the act of responding or of engaging is actually transformative. That's the best thing I can say. That's not purely subjective. Is that it seems like everybody we've talked to, that the act of engaging does act as a salve for the emotional hurt. Okay, got another one here.
You talked about reputation versus privacy versus free speech. I get reputation versus free speech, but could you talk a little bit more about where the privacy comes in and starts playing a big role?
Yeah, sure. So I think what's happened, like for instance with Lane Hartwell, was while she goes to lots of conferences and parties and takes photographs, she was just trying to deal with a copyright violation, what she considered to be a copyright violation, in a private way. It became very public because everything has, it was particularly in the artistic arena, seems to have direction towards the public arena. And all she wanted all along the way was just to have, finish this as a private negotiation, but it couldn't be that. It can never be that after it is exposed. And so she was forced to give up her privacy in the pursuit of addressing her reputation. Others? Okay. We've got another one here.
Hello, thank you. I am of the opinion that there are some people whose reputation needs to get attacked, and I was wondering if you had advice on responsible and or effective ways to do that.
That's good.
So I use the example of Michael Crook, and I think that's a perfect example. It's people who do dastardly things. The internet's designed for attacking them, as you've seen. But I think that it gets satisfaction on the company side. We've given that a lot of thought. Because I think there is a productive way of expressing feelings about of abuse or of things not working. And so part of it is tone, and part of it is doing it in a context where the person can respond. I think if you're going to attack somebody, you absolutely need to give them the ability to, in the context for responding. Next.
My name is Christian Krumlish. I'm Yahoo's pattern detective. And I just want to shamelessly pimp my core conversation tomorrow I'm doing with Ted Nadeau at 5 o'clock on the subject of reputation, identity, attention, presence, and anything else people want to come and talk about it. So if the subject interests you and you feel like sitting around and talking about it, and you're here on Tuesday still at 5 p.m., that's what we're going to be talking about. Thanks.
Jonathan, you have 5 seconds.
How does this apply to people who are extremely public? I'm working on a thing for professional actors. And their whole thing is that they need to be out there as public as possible, but they do have this whole set of very real dangers of stalkers that want to get into their house and kill them. You know, that's a thing that they actually have to deal with. So how would you comfort someone into opening themselves up when there's so much like appetite for any piece of information about them?
That's a great question. I think we're out of time, so I don't think I have time to answer it. And I don't think I know the answer, so thankfully. Thank you all for coming. And don't forget your judo moves.